Hello, my name is Philip Madison, and this is the Roman Republic Podcast. Most people know little about the Roman Republic, or even that ancient Rome was not always ruled by emperors. There are other podcasts that have covered Roman history, but the Roman Republic Podcast will focus on the foundation, establishment, existence of an eventual fall of the Roman Republic. Thanks to Shakespeare, the most popularly known ancient Roman in our modern society is Julius Caesar. You know, the Julius Caesar who slaughtered and enslaved millions of natives in modern-day France, Belgium, and Germany. You know, the guy who crossed the Rubicon in the year 49 BCE, an act that sparked the largest Roman civil war up to that point. That Julius Caesar was born in 100 BCE and died on the Ides of March in 44 BCE. Well, he was assassinated. He didn't really die. But to put some perspective on how long the period of history this podcast will cover, I would like to mention that the city of Rome's mythical foundation date was 750 BCE. Meaning, the story of Rome began over 7 centuries before Julius Caesar cast his die. If you could go back 700 years from today, it would be the year 1320 CE, a time when the Scots officially won independence from the English via the Declaration of Arbroath. Think Braveheart, Robert the Bruce. And, you know, the Black Plague in 1320 was just around the corner. The point is, while most people's knowledge of Roman history does not go beyond a few famous names mentioned in Shakespeare's plays, and then a couple emperors we see in movies, there's a vast period of Roman history to cover before Julius Caesar came onto the scene, before Rome had emperors. So my goal for this podcast is to fill that gap and to share with you the story of the Roman Republic. The city of Rome was founded in 750 BCE, but the Roman Republic as a system of governance was not established until 510-509 BCE. The narrative of this podcast will begin even before the foundation of Rome in 750 BCE. I know, so many dates, just bear with me because it's not that bad. So 750 BCE, establishment of the city of Rome, 510-509, the Republic is established. Why the 240 plus year gap, and why cover events that happened well before the Republic was established? And the answer is, you know, if I begin the narrative when Brutus decided to get revenge for the rape of Lucretia by ousting the Etruscan kings, you may have a few questions about what any of that has to do with the establishment of the Roman Republic. And, you know, point being is that I think it's important to have historical context in order to fully appreciate how spectacular the foundation of a republic in ancient Rome really was. And to give you context, we may as well start at the beginning. So, you know, 240 plus years of additional content may sound like a lot to cover before we even get to the Roman Republic, but trust me when I say it's worth the wait. The period before the Republic was established, you know, it may have scant source material, and it's considered mostly myth and legend. So we won't spend an excessive amount of time on the periods before the Roman Republic was established. But the time we do spend on these myths and legends will tell us what Romans of a later era believed to be their own history. And what I mean by that is, a lot of the sources we get about ancient Rome. They come from a later era, an era, it's really called the late Republican era. And, you know, around the time when the emperor was, you know, first emperor came about, Augustus. And that's, you know, think, you know, when I was talking about Julius Caesar, 100 all the way to maybe when Augustus was, when Augustus died in 14 CE. That's when a lot of these sources came out, and a lot of these sources write and talk about this history of Rome, their history of Rome. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about these foundation myths of Rome, of the Latin people. And that, you know, that's what we're getting into today. So here we go. So our topic for today is the legendary figure Aeneas. And we're going to cover how his saga is important in the history of Rome. So you may not know Aeneas, and I may be pronouncing that incorrectly. I hope not. You definitely know Aeneas's hometown. So let's get into that. Today I'll be using two ancient sources for this episode. And I will also be using them for a large portion of this podcast. And technically I'm using three, but Tacitus, another ancient author, is just to prove a point. But the authors that I'm using today, I will explain in more detail at the end of the episode in the post-show dialogue. Anyway, so who is Aeneas? Firstly, it should be mentioned that, you know, Aeneas, this mythical, legendary, however you want to put it, ancient figure, was thought by the Julio-Claudian family. So think about Julius Caesar, his successors, his family, the first emperors of Rome. Aeneas was, they thought, was the originator, you know, of their family, the original ancestor. And this was a line that led from Aeneas to the Alban kings, to Romulus, the founder of Rome. All the way to Julius Caesar himself. And we see this depicted, this is where Tacitus comes in the funeral of Drusus, who was the son of the emperor Tiberius. And in this funeral, you know, we see there was a bunch of these images. I'm not entirely sure what these images were, what they looked like, but in these funerals, you had these images presented, and one of them was Aeneas. And so in this funeral, they're pointing out that yes, our ancestry of the Julio-Claudians goes all the way back to Aeneas. And this is important because even if Aeneas was not an historical figure, the Romans of a later age than what we are covering believed him to be the founding father of the Latin peoples. So, you know, with that, Livy and Plutarch, the other two sources, the main sources I'm using for today, posit the most believed traditions, and that's a specific way to phrase it. The most believed traditions state that Aeneas was the Trojan ancestor of the kings of Alba, mentioned before, a royal line in central Italy that would lead directly to the twins Romulus and Remus, the two brothers who would establish Rome as a city. And this is the connection between Aeneas and later Rome. But what's Aeneas's story? So let's get into that. Aeneas was exiled from Troy. Yeah, that's right. Troy, after the Trojans were defeated in the Trojan War. What was the Trojan War? Well, two books, mainly the first one, the Iliad and the Odyssey. These were epic pieces of Greek literature written by another Greek named Homer during the 9th century BCE. And the Iliad and the Odyssey, if you're not familiar, I really hope you are. These are some of the most widely known and distributed works in antiquity, in the ancient eras. Figures like Pericles of Athens, Alexander the Great of Macedon, Julius Caesar, countless famous Greek and Roman figures in the ancient world would have been familiar with these works. And they may even have sought to emulate and surpass heroes like Achilles, Ajax, Odysseus. So I'm not going to go as far as tell the whole story of the Iliad, which specifically talks about the Trojan War. Odyssey is about Odysseus's trip back home. So that's a little separate. But the Iliad, features this decade-long war between the Greeks and the Trojans way back in the day. It's not entirely known when this war occurred or if it happened. So I'm not going to tell the whole story, but I will spoil the outcome. Unfortunately, the Greeks sail to the city that was known in the ancient world as Troy. And Troy is not a modern city, but the ruins are located close to the northeastern coast of modern Turkey, bordering the Aegean Sea. So we see Troy was besieged for 10 years. But the Greeks, the aggressors, eventually take the city through deception, think Trojan horse, and they sack Troy. So this is where our story supposedly merges with the outcome of the Trojan War. And Aeneas comes into play. So Aeneas is a Trojan. He was just defeated by the Greeks. But the Greeks exercised what's called the ancient rite of hospitality after the sack of Troy, which means that Aeneas and his followers were given the chance to leave in peace. So thank you, Greeks, for letting Aeneas go. So now Aeneas and his followers are without a home, seemingly without hope, and the Trojans begin to wander west and search for a new home. So picture, a heroic figure standing on the bow of a wooden ship, wind blowing on his hair. He's got, this long silky hair with a sword on his back. And he's got all these warrior followers with him, Trojan warriors. And, they're on this boat and they're about to go on this epic journey on the high seas of the Mediterranean. That's just kind of paint a picture. The source I'm using for this story is Livy, and he gives a brief summary of the life of Aeneas and his travels. The reason I bring this up is because another source covers Aeneas, Virgil's Aeneid, and this was written during the life of Augustus, Rome's first princeps or emperor. And Virgil's work, the Aeneid, gives a mythological account of the adventures Aeneas and his followers went on, while they're in a search for a new home after the sack of Troy. And while this account is interesting, that's Virgil's Aeneid, it really deserves a podcast of its own due to its length and detail. I'm not covering Virgil's Aeneid in his version of these events. I am going to use Livy's account. And so here we go. Livy's account of Aeneas and his followers after their exile depicts them, they're sailing away from Troy. So picture that little sea between Greece and Turkey. And he sails to Macedon being the home of Alexander the Great, north of modern Greece. But doesn't like Macedon, so they sail to Sicily. Sicily later on in time in the ancient world, will be this, Hellenized center. It'll be have some very wealthy cities, including Syracuse. But they don't like it there either. No Greeks there yet. So they probably wouldn't like that anyway. So they don't land in Sicily. They kept sailing until they got to an area called Laurentum, which is in ancient Latium, 15 miles south of Rome. I say Latium implying Latins. That hasn't happened yet. We'll get there. But that's the area. Central Italy, 15 miles south of Rome. That's where the Trojans get off of their glorious ship. They land, and Aeneas finally arrives to Italy. So we're where we need to be. We're in Italy. And Aeneas and his followers are armed and starving. So that's never really a good combination. And as we'll see, the Trojans began to pillage the lands around them. This region of Laurentum. And they basically just stole from the locals to feed themselves. When you do that, especially in the ancient world, but, really anywhere, you steal from the locals, you eventually meet the protectors of the land. And in this case, that is a man that was named King Latinus. He was the king of Laurentine territory. And Latinus, and what Livy refers to as his aborigine people, basically the people who lived and served under King Latinus, just picture a king and his people, they're not enthused with these foreign warriors pillaging their lands. So King Latinus and his people and his army marched from the city to meet this new threat. And this confrontation, there's two versions. The first one's rather quick and to the point. The armies meet. Aeneas and the Trojans defeat King Latinus. A peace treaty was sealed. And the political marriage between King Latinus' daughter and Aeneas takes place. This is kind of short, to the point, but doesn't really have as much meat to it. So we're going to cover the second version, Livy's second version of these events, which I prefer, I like, because length and detail. But even Livy, he prevents this version as the most believed story, meaning that's what Romans, mostly would have believed to be the story. So Aeneas is in Italy, King Latinus meets him, and the two armies are, across the field looking at each other. There's no detail on the makeup, size, or location of these armies in the battle. That's not something that we see a lot in this period of time, because this battle may not even have happened. But as the Romans believed, these two armies are facing each other, and before the signal for battle could be made, King Latinus and his retinue, they want to ride out and meet Aeneas. He hopes to gauge the reason for this conflict, and he wants to ask King Latinus, that is, wants to ask Aeneas some questions. And this is a quote from Livy. He's talking about, this is King Latinus saying this supposedly, quote, what kind of men they, sorry, this is King Latinus asking Aeneas, quote, what kind of men they were, where they had come from, what misfortune had caused them to leave their home, and what they wanted in Laurentine territory. And that's Livy, book 1.1, page 6. So let's kind of dissect that quote, because it says a lot. First, and weirdly, this question, just you wouldn't really hear it most often, but what kind of men they were. What does that mean? Well, in this instance, he's asking if Aeneas and his followers are mortals or divine, and which is weird, but in the ancient world, it's not, because there's a lot of gods. There's a lot of people that claim to be sons of gods. But Aeneas answers King Latinus, and he says that he and his people are searching for a place to build a city that can be their new home after the sack of their old home, Troy. And Aeneas also says that he was the son of a man named Anchises of Troy, and guess what? Venus. So in response to being asked what kind of men they were, he's saying, yes, my mother is Venus, the Latin god of victory, love, sex, beauty, fertility. Greeks or Hellenes might would have called her Aphrodite. And so Aeneas is saying, yes, I am the daughter of a goddess, okay? And this is something that we see later on in a lot of figures, but namely Julius Caesar. Julius Caesar claimed ancestry leading to Venus, the goddess. And this was because Julia, as I mentioned before, Julius Caesar and the Julio-Claudian family believe their heritage led all the way back to Aeneas and through Aeneas to Venus. And this is why this is important, because you have these big families down the road, namely the Julians, saying that, yeah, our ancestry goes back to Aeneas. We're a big deal. But anyway, so that's just a point that we're going to see mentioned later on in the podcast. But so that's it. Aeneas says, I'm the son of Venus. And, you know, King Latinus was impressed with the character of Aeneas, but also with his divine parentage. So instead of fighting a battle, Aeneas and King Latinus reach an accord. And this is a quote of Livy. This is King Latinus. This is a quote from Livy. King Latinus, quote, offered his right hand as a pledge of their future friendship. A treaty was made between the two leaders. The armies saluted each other, and Aeneas became a guest in the house of Latinus. And this public treaty between Aeneas and King Latinus was reinforced by a political marriage of King Latinus's daughter to Aeneas. So everything's all jolly, no battle, the two guys like each other, and he's like, hey, marry my daughter. So just real quick about quotes from Livy and other ancient sources. Livy probably made, you know, this isn't a quote of King Latinus saying something, but the one earlier when it was King Latinus asking Aeneas something, quotes like these, it's hard to think about, but Livy did not find this quote on some paper and write it down and say, this is what, he made this up. Most ancient sources felt the need to insert what they think the figure being discussed would have said. And, in ancient writers inventing quotes and speeches, while it often attracts the ire of historians, history lovers like myself, we would just roll with it. You know, this is gold. So I'm going to keep quoting like that, but just know that, you know, if I'm quoting from an ancient author and he's quoting an ancient figure, don't like hear that and go like, wow, I'm hearing directly from the mouth of the person in question. That's not always the case. But these quotes tell us a lot about what people, ancient Romans specifically, thought about figures like these. Public treaty between Latinus and Aeneas is signed. And on top of that, Aeneas now has in his followers, they now have a new home. So they're safe from these perilous wanderings they've been on. There's enough with the long hair, the sword, and the boat. He's cut the hair. He still has a sword, though. And they have a new home. They establish a new city named Lavinium after Aeneas' new wife, Lavinia. And the two have a son named Ascanius. And he's going to be a big deal later on. So everything seems dandy, except that this accord between Aeneas and Latinus ruffles a few feathers. Namely, a group named the Rutulians, under a king named Turnus. So in Livy's book 1.2, you know, we see Aeneas has his new city. He's established a new leadership role in central Italy, but it begins to come in conflict with other local peoples. So enter the Rutulians. The Rutulians were an Italic people living in the area called Ardea, which is south of Lavinium. And I didn't tell you where Lavinium was, but eventually I'll get a map up on my site and you guys can see what's going on here. But Turnus, the Rutulian king, He was engaged to Lavinia, the daughter of King Latinus, and this was prior to Aeneas arriving to Italy. So if you can imagine, he was not happy with King Latinus because he had chosen this foreigner to marry his daughter over himself. And don't hear the word foreigner and take that as a negative. I'm purely meaning to convey that you have these two local Italian kings that made a deal, and it just seems like Aeneas shows up, bangs on his chest a few times, King Latinus caves and lets his daughter marry Aeneas, not this other Italian king, King Turnus. So the Rutulians and King Turnus specifically did not take kindly to this, did not take kindly to losing his future wife. So they declare war on the Rutulians, that is, declare war on King Latinus and Aeneas. And it doesn't go well for both sides. The Rutulians were defeated, but King Latinus died as a result of the war. So, you know, so long, King Latinus, unfortunately. But in their defeat, the Rutulians would turn to an Etruscan king named Mezentius for assistance in his war against Aeneas. So we got a lot of names coming up, a lot of groups of people. Clear things up real quick. We have four groups of people Livy mentions in this part of the story. You have the Trojans, led by Aeneas. You have the Aborigines, who served under King Latinus. You have the Rutulians under King Turnus. And now you have the Etruscans under King Mezentius. So, quickly, I'm not going to go into the Rutulians because they're, you know, I'm sure they might come up later. They may not. But the Etruscans definitely will. The Etruscans are a big deal in this podcast and in this episode. So, who are the Etruscans? The Etruscans were a non-Indo-European speaking people. Who another ancient author, Herodotus, claimed came from Asia Minor, modern Turkey. And these Etruscans were basically an ethnic group in Italy. They inhabited the lands north of the Tiber River, south of the Po Valley. And as I said, they're going to be a big deal, play a major role in the narrative of this podcast. And in the history of the Roman Republic. So I will cover them in more detail later, but just a quick fun fact, if you don't recognize Etruscans, think Etruscans, Tuscans, Tuscany. So just think Tuscany, Italy, and you're not too far from where they came from. But the Etruscans, you know, I said they inhabited this large area north of the Tiber, south of the Po Valley. But they were not a politically unified kingdom, per se, as you know, they were ruled by one king or one ruler. A lot of these Etruscan kings simply ruled over a city in the country around them. But the Etruscans in general, as a group, as an ethnic group, were said to be wealthy as well as famous for their power throughout Italy. And this is another quote from Livy, quote, "But Etruria was so powerful that not only the lands, but also the sea along the extent of Italy from the Alps to the Straits of Sicily were filled with the glory of her name." And this means that, back to Aeneas, he needs to worry about the Etruscans. He needs to worry about King Mezentius. Because this is the time where the Etruscans were on high. They were powerful. They were capable, supposedly. So King Mezentius specifically inserts into the story. He ruled over a wealthy city named Caere. I'm not sure if I pronounce that right. It's spelled C-A-E-R-E. But he is another local ruler. He's been asked by the Rutulians to join the war. And besides that, King Mezentius had his own reasons to want to fight Aeneas and the Trojans. The new city that Aeneas founded, Lavinium, was expanding, and the Trojan state was growing faster than their neighbors thought was acceptable. You have a new player on the block, think Germany after their unification in the 1870s. A lot of powers didn't take very well to having, you know, the greatest military power on earth come together overnight. Well, the Trojans under Aeneas have this new city. They're making noise. They're becoming more powerful. And, you know, this makes the decision for King Mezentius to join the war on the side of the Rutulians a lot easier. So now you have Aeneas against these two kings, this coalition against them, and what does he do? Aeneas seeks to unite the Aborigines that were led under King Latinus and his own people, the Trojans. And what we have here is a legendary event, the foundation of the Latin peoples in central Italy. If you don't know what Latin is, I'm sorry, but you know, this is a big deal. This is a huge deal. Aeneas, this legendary figure, creates the Latin people. The Latin people will be, you know, it'll be this region I mentioned earlier, Latium, where you have all of these Latin-speaking cities. This Latin culture, Rome included, and what Livy is saying here is thanks to Aeneas. He's the one that founded these peoples in this legendary accomplishment. And this is an example of taking mythic figures and posthumously pinning certain events and accomplishments to their name. This is a theme we see a lot in the ancient world. If we want to talk about another culture that did this, think of the Spartans. They had this legendary mythic figure named Lycurgus, who they believed was, you know, an ancient leader of Sparta that pushed through all these reforms in the Spartan government and created this martial culture. And obviously I'm brushing over this real quick. But the point is that, you know, the Spartans, they posthumously were like, yes, Lycurgus did all of this. All of our success, our government, our martial culture, it's thanks to Lycurgus. And while Lycurgus may have been real, there's no way of telling if he was responsible for making the Spartans what we know of them today as this like killer city that went around. They were the best warriors. And, you know, and the point being is to go back to Aeneas, you have the Romans going back and creating this cross-cultural figure in Aeneas, cross-cultural meaning he was known in Greek sources, and now he's coming over to Roman and Latin sources, and they're saying he's the one that founded the Latin peoples. He's the one that, you know, established our race, our ethnicity, our language. He's the beginning. And they probably did this, you know, this is probably a bunch of historians in a room, you know, writers going like, you know, I think he did this. And this is a theme. And the reason I'm harping on this is because this is a theme we will see a lot in the ancient world. We are going to see it in this podcast, but you will see it in all these other cultures where you take a figure in the past, a mythic figure, and you ancient sources, ancient peoples will pin these accomplishments, as I said, to their name, even though it may not be true. And so in this war against the Etruscans and the Rutulians, we have this legendary event occur. Did it happen? We're not sure. But for the sake of the story, let's go with it. Aeneas is facing this large coalition, and he basically takes, King Latinus is dead, so he takes his people, King Latinus is that is, and he takes, Aeneas takes his Trojans, and he's like, we're together now, we are the Latin people. Aeneas became king over this Latin people. So now they have one set of laws and have unificate, and they have a unification that will help these new Latins fight this formidable coalition against them. So King Aeneas has this new Latin army, and he leads them into battle against the Etruscans and the Rutulians. And again, we don't have a lot of info on the battle itself, but we know that the sources say King Aeneas won the battle. Fortunately, it was at the cost of his life. So I know that was just a quick end to Aeneas. But I think there's a little quote from Livy that is a fitting tribute. Quote, the Latins were successful in battle, but it was the last of Aeneas's mortal labors. Whatever it is lawful and right that he be called, be it god or man, he is buried by the river Numicus. Men called him Jupiter and DJs. And, you know, this is a, in quote, this is a sad end to a legendary figure. But we're going to cut this quote up a little bit. I like to do that. If you don't recognize the phrase mortal labors, you might want to take another look at Hercules, the movie, or just his history. Hercules' 12 labors were legendary back in the ancient world than they are today. Hercules is a Greek-style hero. If we were talking Greek, he would be Heracles, but the actual name Hercules is the Latin version, Hercules. Why am I talking about Hercules? Well, in this quote, it says it was the last of Aeneas's mortal labors and that men called him Jupiter in DJs. Well, Hercules had these mortal labors that he had to accomplish, and then he either died or just became a god afterward. Well, that is exactly what's happening to Aeneas right here. Hercules was a Greek-style hero that became a god after his many mortal labors. Aeneas was a Latin-style hero that also became a god after his many mortal labors. And, you know, this is, again, this is another thing that's really important because, you know, we may know these great famous Greek myths, but Roman myths are not as well known. And Aeneas was right up there as one of the Romans' mythical founding figures. So next week, we are going to continue with the story of Ascanius leading all the way to Romulus and Remus, the founders of Rome, and supposedly the direct descendants of the great Aeneas we covered today. But to wrap up, I'd like to say that most people they could care less for a boring history story that in their minds has no bearing on life today. But one of my long-term goals for the Roman Republic podcast is to make the history of the Roman Republic as interesting as any of the best fiction novels out there. Except instead of telling one story, this podcast will give you centuries of stories, myths, historical events and figures, dramas, wars. We're even going to talk about the first ever recorded Roman crossdresser / gang leader. And he was a pretty cool guy. The figures and events we discussed in the first part of this podcast series, namely the foundation myths of Rome, may not be, you know, historical fact, but the famous Roman figures we do know existed, such as Marius, Sulla, Julius Caesar, Augustus, may have believed these foundation myths of Rome to be real, and other Romans certainly did. And that's not to say that Livy was the only Roman to question the historicity of these stories. But nonetheless, you know, the source we used today, Livy, was passing history down. He was writing the traditions as they were passed down to him, and thus passed down to us. So a lot of what we're covering, this is what Romans wrote about as their history, whether or not they believed it to be true. And that's why we're covering it, is because, like I said, Roman figures that we do know existed looked back on this and took it as history of their people. But that's it for today. And I hope everyone has a good one. Next, I'll be doing the post-show dialogue, which I talk about sources, general remarks, personal opinions. But that's it for today. Have a good one. This is the Roman Republic Podcast. So this is the post-show dialogue. And what I'd like to say is, you know, today we were talking about foundation myths of the Roman and Latin people. All I'd like to say is just bear with me because, you know, while this period is extremely interesting, the later periods we discuss, especially when we get into, well, relatively soon, get into Romulus and Remus, some of the kings. But when we get to the Roman Republic, it gets incredibly interesting because the things that happen, I mean, it's just this in this, you know, the material we have much more of it. But I'd like to quote Livy because I thought this was so funny, that he said this, and I'll explain it afterward. This is a quote from Livy, quote, "I have no doubt that the earliest and immediately succeeding periods will give less delight to the majority of readers who are hurrying to these recent times in which the might of the most powerful people has long been destroying itself." So the way it's phrased is a little weird, but when he's saying hurrying to these recent times, he's referring to his own lifetime, when great figures like Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, Brutus, Augustus, were all participating in these massive Roman civil wars. And the point that Livy and I are in agreement in is that the later in history we go when it comes to Roman history, the more interesting it gets. And he's basically saying, I have no doubt the earliest and immediately succeeding periods will give less delight to the majority of readers who are hurrying to these recent times. You know, what they're saying is, I get it. You know, these parts, they're not as interesting. They're not as gripping as the later periods he'll talk about, and that's kind of true, mainly because, you know, if we had the kind of source material we do on these earlier periods, maybe it would be a different story, but we don't. So Livy's saying that, hey, I know this first part can be a little boring, but, you know, because I know readers want to hurry to these recent times, to my times, when you have these larger-than-life figures that are covered by Shakespeare, like I said earlier on. But anyway, we're going to talk about sources a little bit. One of the sources I'm using for this episode is a 2,000-year-old author named Titus Livius, or more commonly referred to as Livy. I am using Valerie M. Warrior's translation of Livy's The History of Rome, books 1-5, where Valerie M. Warrior, she provides a wonderful introduction, and her footnotes are extremely helpful to me, and they're going to get me through this podcast, you know, to be honest. But Livy's bodies of works cover the history of Rome from before its foundation to his own lifetime, when the Roman Republic had more or less already fallen. So he's writing in a period where, you know, our narrative is going to end. And Livy was, you know, being born, he was born 59 BCE. So that's about the time that, Julius Caesar in the first triumvirate were kind of taking power away from the Roman Republic. But, you know, why am I talking about Livy in the podcast as opposed to simply using him as a source? And really the reason is because the rest of us, Livy was human, and to be human is to err. He made mistakes, he had opinions, he had biases, however you say it. But his personal commentary, as well as the way he phrases certain things, can tell us a story just as detailed as the story about Rome. For example, Livy remarked on his own objectivity about his works in his preface by saying, quote, "The intent is neither to affirm or refute the traditions that belong to the period before the foundation of the city or the anticipation of its foundation, for these are embellished with poetic tales rather than based on uncorrupted records of historical events." A lot of words. But basically, comments like this hint at the fact that Livy was just conveying the traditions that were passed down to him. He's not confirming what he's writing about is accurate. And this is especially important in the early phase of Roman history, because while, you know, most of what we cover may be rooted in historical events and figures, you know, over time, a lot of these things like Aeneas became clouded in myths and legends. Or the foundation of Rome, specifically. So, Livy's great. We're going to love him. The second source I'll be relying on throughout this podcast as well is another 2,000-plus-year-old man named Plutarch, who was an ancient biographer who wrote about famous Greek and Roman figures throughout history. In his book, Plutarch's Lives, Volume 1, the one I'm using is translated by John Dryden. John Dryden, say that 10 times. Plutarch and his works will help us see that an ancient biographer can give us a much more in-depth look at ancient historical figures. You know, looking at their personalities, their likes, their dislikes, their habits. Sometimes we'll even see what they could have eaten. And you know, so Plutarch, while I didn't use him a lot today, he is going to give us a colored picture of what we cannot actually see. And I love that. I think you guys will love it. But both of these authors, they're writing about events that happened well before their own lifetimes. But they supposedly rely on other ancient sources who may have had firsthand accounts or live closer to the times in questions. And, you know, this is important because we don't really have many other people to rely on. So while authors like Livy, I mean, talk to any historian that knows Livy and they will get pissed off because a lot of what he says is just downright wrong in certain instances where historians can prove otherwise. But he's all we have. And on top of that, Livy, when he released his works, I mean, Romans that we know were reading this and going like, wow, this is our history, you know. So the reason I'm discussing all boring source material is because we are seeing history through the words that they left behind. And their words can tell us a lot. So that is it for today. And I got to come up with a good way, like word or phrase to end things on because I'm not good at it. But I'll just say, see you later.